Deutschlandfunk. Corso. Kunst und Pop.
What was the idea when you started writing this book? What was your goal?
The list, as I'm sure you know, has its roots in the David Bowie Is exhibition that ran, well, it opened in London in 2014 and then it travelled around the world. And its first port of call after London was Ontario in Canada. And to celebrate the opening of the show in Ontario, Bowie released this list of his 100 favourite books. Now, some of these books had actually been suspended from the ceiling as part of the original exhibition. So we kind of had a sense that books were part of his world and you know, connected to his artistry in some way. But this, it was great to get this list straight from source. And as soon as this list was released, it quickly went viral and people started having book clubs and, you know, going through the list in quite some detail, looking for clues and that kind of thing. And that's really what interested me. But as a long-term Bowie fan, I mean, I'm someone who has been a Bowie fan since I was about 11, you know. So it was just fascinating to me. And I thought it would be a really interesting exercise to really go through the list and try and work out what it was about those books that was so important to him, to really try and think my way into his head.
Bowie once said that he listened to other people's music, mostly for inspiration, for ideas he could use in his own music. So do you think it was the same with readings, you know, to get something out of it?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think he had that magpie-like mind. I think when he read things, the first thing on his mind was, what can I take from this and can I use it in some way? You know, he was looking for shiny things all the time. One of the most personal books on the list for him is a book called A Grave for a Dolphin by an Italian doctor called Alberto Denti di Furano, who was posted to Italy's colonies in Africa between the 1920s and the 1940s. And it's this very strange erotic fable. And it turns out that that's the source of the line about wishing you could swim like dolphins could swim, the famous line in Heroes. And, you know, you would never have thought that at all, but that's where he got that line from. And it's why he had a tattoo of a dolphin on his ankle. And it was a very important book, both for him and for Iman, his wife.
And after each chapter, each book of Bowie's list, you suggest in your book a song of his to listen to. So, I don't know, what's the link between Madame Bovary and Bowie's Life on Mars?
Actually, that was one of the hardest things about writing the book was coming up with a song. I felt like it would be a nice thing to do, to come up with a song. And I think really the subject there is suburban boredom. You know, Madame Bovary, I think, is the ultimate exquisite book about, you know, the drabness of provincial life to someone who really wants life to be more exciting and than just, you know, hanging around. And really that's what for me Life on Mars is about as well. So I thought there was a kind of sympathetic magic between those two artworks, even though there isn't a direct link. Sometimes the link is more kind of impressionistic and, you know, not quite tangible.
And is there a book where you would say that's so Bowie, of course you would read that?
I think T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland is a really important book for him. He was very interested in early 20th century art and modernism. And I think the idea of the world being a heap of broken images, to use T.S. Eliot's line, and also the idea that you could make art out of fragments of stuff that you just find lying around. And that's something that he did himself in his music, but I think an idea he really liked. And of course, The Wasteland is really the prototypical poem for doing that. And I think it was hugely influential. I think a lot of the beat writing on the list as well, On the Road, is a hugely influential book for him. It was given to him by his half-brother, Terry, when he was a, you know, very young, impressionable teenager. And I think you can't overstate its importance to him. And I think that idea of, you know, beatnik life, that the flaring Roman candle, you know, burning brightly, that idea, very important to him. He never lost it.
These kind of lists, like favorite books or desert island discs, they're often a means to construct a certain image of oneself. So especially when we think of Bowie, the actor and quite mysterious chameleon, do you think it's an honest list?
I think it's both. I think it is an honest list, because I do believe that he read most of them, because it's, some of the books are so personal that there's no sense in them being there if he didn't read them, especially a lot of the books from his childhood, like Keith Waterhouse, which would have been a very important book to him growing up. But I think also he is always mindful of what the list looks like as a sort of totality. And I wondered if, I think there's a kind of game playing aspect to it. I think it's quite carefully structured. And I think he half intended people like me to kind of latch onto it and try and work out what he was doing, you know. So there are lots of built-in banana skins, if you like. And I sometimes felt like I was being sent off on a kind of wild goose chase, and like I was in a maze and I didn't quite know how to get out of it. And I think that's intentional. I think he's playing a game with his fans.
And I found quite intriguing this image of him taking his shelf along, or having that shelf in the limousine, or taking a suitcase of books along on tour. Was it a bit showy as well?
Possibly. I mean, yes, he had this custom-made library. I mean, it was like, apparently it was built out of, it was a bit like the boxes that you carry amplifiers in. So, you know, this great vast thing that could store thousands of books. And yeah, I think you're right. There was something a bit flamboyant about it, a bit wanting to let everybody know how much he was reading. But then apparently he genuinely did read these books. I mean, he famously took this portable library onto the set of The Man Who Fell to Earth, which he was filming in New Mexico. And his co-stars on the film remember him disappearing off into his little caravan and reading constantly when he wasn't involved in the film. So it wasn't just for show. You know, he did read these books.
And when you came out of the maze, do you feel you understand him better now after analysing his book list?
I do, actually, because I think it humanised him, and the list makes him slightly more three-dimensional. That's not the same as saying it's biographical, because I don't think it's biographical. And I think the list is very aware of what literary critics call the biography problem. And actually, it's got one of the best books about the biography problem on the list, in the form of Julian Barnes' Flaubert's Parrot. It does help me see him as a less austere kind of character, because there are various times in his career he was quite keen to promote himself as this quite cold, unforgiving, slightly inhuman kind of character. I think that the Thin White Duke becomes less scary and austere if you imagine him sitting down and reading Keith Waterhouse.
Yeah, and he does have the reputation of being a quite friendly, loyal, empathic person, in spite of his ego and his stardom and his, I don't know, his cocaine abuse. And you go so far as saying that reading books made him so, a better person. What makes you think that?
I mean, I don't think it's probably not a very fashionable idea, but I think when done in the right way, I think making books does make you a better person, just in the sense that it expands your consciousness. It, you know, it helps you understand other people. And, you know, the more we understand other people, the better we are as people. I think that's the route to moral goodness, moral worth. And I think he understood that too. I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me after he died was how few people had a bad word to say about him. And quite often when people as famous as David Bowie die, you know, all the people come out of the woodwork to say, oh, well, he did this to me, he did that to me, you know. And there was none of that at all. You know, there was this global outpouring of grief that was very genuine, and the tributes from his peers. I mean, I don't think I've ever read tributes like that. I mean, all the people who'd worked with him, or even in quite a lowly capacity, had the highest regard for him and the way that he treated them. And I think that's quite remarkable. There are very few people, I think, of his stature who could provoke a response like that.